Hey guys, this week we got to catch up with one of our favorite physicians and medical heroes, Dr. Peter McCullough. Now you can go back through our archives over the last 4 years and hear how Dr. McCullough has been a trusted resource for all things COVID because he's a true medical researcher. He's one of the most published doctors, cardiologists in the world, but he's also just a courageous and compassionate human that we really love. And he just wanted people to know the truth about COVID so that they could heal and protect themselves. And it came at a personal cost to him, for sure. You can hear about that in our previous episodes. We now know for sure that that COVID vaccine was very dangerous. And his research has really helped guide us through that COVID era. But it's also led to new discoveries in medicine for him as well, which is the truth behind vaccines in general. His latest book is called Vaccines, Mythology, Ideology, and Reality, and it's just debuted. He co-authored it with John Leake, whom we've also had the privilege of interviewing, and he does a deep dive on the history of vaccines to really separate fact from fiction, and we really encourage everyone to read it along with us. So in this episode, we're going to talk about that, but we also get to learn the latest on that COVID vaccine side effects, things like how it can shed, how we can all possibly detox from it, both the shot and the virus if we've had it. But we also get to ask him about another topic that we have been interested in his take on, and that is statins. There's been a lot of controversy around one of the most prescribed drugs in the world, and we have a lot of questions about it. And we know of cardiologists that we also respect, like Dr. Asim Malhotra, who has spoken out about the side effects and perhaps lack of efficacy of statins. So we were curious about Dr. McCullough's take, and it is different than Dr. Malhotra's. So you'll get to hear about that as well. So take a listen as we catch up with one of the most courageous and investigative doctors of our lifetimes, Dr. Peter McCullough. Well, hey, hey, everybody. Welcome to Just Think, the podcast. This is Holly.
And Amy.
And Kristen.
And joining us today in our fourth square is our favorite cardiologist and one of our medical heroes and one of our listeners' favorite doctors, Dr. Peter McCullough. We are so happy that you are back with us today. And even though we are smiling and excited just because we love you, we respect you, we thank you for all that you have done. My husband said to me this morning before he hit the golf course, he said, "Hey, tell Dr. McCullough thank you for everything." And I just, and we mean that sincerely, Dr. McCullough, because it was medical heroes like you and Dr. Pierre Corey and countless others that we've had the pleasure of interviewing, Dr. Robert Malone, who have come out and sounded the alarms saying there are treatments for COVID and the vaccine isn't the answer. And you have lost so much. And if you guys, if you have not listened to our interviews with Dr. McCullough before, you can go back in our archives and hear his whole story. We have so much to catch up on with him today. We don't want to waste any time revisiting things we've talked about before. We want to talk about 2025. Because in the 5 years that we have watched you, really 4.5 years, we've watched you, Dr. McCullough. I remember the day I was in Arizona driving in my car. Someone sent us a YouTube video of this cardiologist, the most peer-reviewed cardiologist, I think, in history. And we were listening to him say, "Hey, something's going on with this whole COVID thing. Never before have doctors not collaborated, come up with therapeutics. Never before have we been silenced and said, just trust the science, just trust the government. This is weird." And we all felt a collective sigh of relief. We all said, "Oh, there's experts who have the courage to speak out." And you haven't stopped. We have followed you every step of the way, whether you were speaking in Washington, D.C. or in local legislatures, and you have said repeatedly you've never changed in spite of tremendous backlash and loss. You've been dogged in your pursuit of getting the truth out. And so, Dr. McCullough, today in 2025, what do we now know? What is now becoming more mainstream knowledge that you've helped us discover about COVID as far as therapeutics and COVID the vaccine? We're going to let you talk.
Well, thank you so much, Kristen, Amy, and Holly. You know, I follow all of you on Instagram, and I have to say, Kristen, I watch her do all these incredible exercises And so I did finally have my first yoga lesson. I was in a resort down in Mexico. And then Kristen responded. She said, "You can't imagine how happy I am." I was so stiff because I've been behind the keyboard or in the office with patients for the last 6 years for this rolling disaster that we've witnessed. And I can tell you what's becoming accepted. You know, I just testified in the U.S. Senate on May 21st, 2025. I was the lead witness. You know, there's a full report on this. The U.S. government, all the public health agencies, they all knew the vaccines were causing heart damage or myocarditis. Man. I was seeing this in my practice. And the U.S. government worked to cover it up with the public health agencies. They wanted more people to get injected. Sadly, more people develop myocarditis. Now, a recent Rasmussen survey poll, it's one of the best out there, indicates 51% of Americans now know the vaccines cause heart damage.
Wow.
Yep. I mean, and you were saying, we know you were saying this because we were covering it. And so I think, you know, we try not to be I told you so-ers, but we really were reporting in real time what you were uncovering, what other doctors were uncovering. And you haven't been wrong, Dr. McCullough. I mean, you just haven't. And but what I will say about you, and I think what we want to get into today, you are a physician with humility. So I love this balance that you carry of courage and strength. But you have a humility as a physician to go, hey, I'm not God. I don't have all the answers to everything. And I'm learning in real time many things. And I love that you're sharing it. We're going to get into childhood vaccines because you now are diving into that, which you know we are so passionate about. But I want to talk about that. But I want to also say you are treating, in fact, before we hit live, you said, I got to go deal with a patient that's just had a cardiac arrest due to the COVID vaccine. Dr. McCullough, how do you know, is there a way to tell that someone's having this as a result of the vaccine or if they had something that was building up for years and now it's finally caught up to them? Do you know the difference? How do you know?
Well, I published a peer-reviewed paper in the World Journal of Cardiology, and you know, I think uniquely out of all the medical commentators you see on national TV, I'm the only one who's publishing in the peer-reviewed literature. And we published a risk stratification approach where, as doctors, we try to piece together the case. Now, we do a detailed vaccine and COVID history. We measure antibodies against the spike protein as a proxy for how much spike protein has accumulated in the body, you know, largely from the vaccines. And then do a series of cardiac testing. And of course, we're paying attention to the medical literature. So a recent report from Japan has found the spike protein in the lining of the blood vessels that have burst in the brain, causing fatal strokes. So we know the spike protein is there. Crossan and colleagues from Harvard has found Pfizer and Moderna physically in the heart. It's physically there. The messenger RNA is in the heart. And then when stained, the spike protein from the vaccine seems to be everywhere. So we try to piece it together. We know that the vaccine does accelerate atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, which happened in my patient, where he's younger than me, and he's urgently had to have coronary artery stenting. Now, there are other determinants, other factors. You know, traditional cardiac risk factors are elevated cholesterol, blood pressure, diabetes, family history, and smoking. So there's other factors. But when we don't have those other factors, we have the vaccine, we have high antibodies to the vaccine, we can actually now send blood tests to a lab in Germany called the Inmodia lab. And, you know, in my patients, I've found circulating spike protein from the vaccine in the bloodstream. We found Pfizer and Moderna in the bloodstream. We've also found it in the skin and skin biopsies. So this vaccine goes everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember when they told us, Dr. McCullough, when they were mandating this vaccine for so many, and they said it just stays in the arm. Do you remember? And they were saying it doesn't. That was considered misinformation. I think we even got maybe in trouble for sharing that it was, in fact, going throughout the entire body. It was not staying localized. And why does that matter, Dr. McCullough? Why would it matter? I mean, why would they even say, just because you understand vaccinology better than the average person, okay, so we want to just keep it here so that why? I mean, help us understand why that was a big deal to the average person.
The Pfizer, Moderna, and the Janssen and AstraZeneca vaccines. Now, Janssen and AstraZeneca were pulled off the market, which is the right thing to do. The companies knew the vaccines weren't safe. But Pfizer and Moderna have kept theirs on the market. Novavax is still on the market as well as an antigen-based vaccine. But Pfizer and Moderna are the genetic code for the lethal part of the virus, the spike protein. This was known ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And when the proposal came out to install the genetic code in the human body for the disease-causing and potentially lethal spike protein, I knew it was a terrible idea before the vaccines ever rolled out. And I put it in writing in an opinion editorial in The Hill, which is a widely read journal. I'm the only public figure, by the way, in writing who questioned this. And you know, if you ask artificial intelligence, they'll say Robert F. Kennedy had questions and Sherry Tenpenny and a few others. But I was the only one to get it in writing. That's been a great privilege of mine to have publication power to do that. And that when we put things in writing or we put it in a video, we've kind of time stamped it and date stamped it. So we've got it nailed down. It was a horrible idea. So if the vaccine just stayed in the arm and the spike protein was not allowed out of the arm, then the body could form an immunity to it and it potentially could have a benefit. But as soon as those lipid nanoparticles begin to circulate through the body, install the genetic code and all the vital organs of the body, and it's been found everywhere now, brain, heart, intestines, skin, all over. The spike protein then is produced in an uncontrolled fashion, uncontrolled duration and quantity. And as the spike protein is inside cells, it damages the cells, it's expressed on the cell surface, the body attacks those cells. And then, you know, frighteningly, it's in the bloodstream. So I have a patient of mine, we've used this advanced lab in Germany. He has circulating spike protein over 3 years after the vaccine. It's in his bloodstream. And this poor guy has had blood clots, pulmonary embolism, myocarditis. He's terribly afraid of cancer, and he should be.
I'm going to add to that. If y'all remember our interview with Lindsay House and Bree Dressen, Lindsay texted me. I asked her because she was on an interview recently. I think it was on with Children's Health Defense. But she said, this was just yesterday. She says, so today is 1,680 days of continuous spike protein production in my immune system. So she has been tested and her immune system is like tanked. And she is saying, because I know that we've got, and correct me if I'm wrong or if she's wrong, but I'm sure she probably knows because she has been like with everybody. But apparently there are definitely ways to get the spike protein like to like slow it down maybe, right? But She said the things that are helping is just mitigating the symptoms, but it's reverse transcribed in me. So that means the RNA has transcribed itself into the nucleus of cells, particularly the monocyte lines. That's where the problem is. But she was saying the RNA has reverse transcribed. So things are helping to mitigate the symptoms. But since she's a factory, which we've heard this say, you're like a spike protein factory. That nothing will really help until they find the off switch to the spike protein mechanism cause. Once they find the off switch, then they can clear it. Is that like what they're trying to figure out right now, Dr. McCullough?
A couple of issues. One, the messenger RNA itself appears to be long-lasting and indestructible. And that's what the Nobel Prize was awarded for. It's called pseudouridination to Carrico and Weissman. So the messenger RNA alone is a great concern. We're finding it in the body years after the shots. That's just the messenger RNA, and it gets passed from cell to cell and makes more and more spike protein. Now, you're right. We can get ahead of it by dissolving the spike protein. That's done with McCullough protocol-based spike protein detoxification. It's the only proven method where we use natokinase, bromelain, and curcumin together. And other proteolytic enzymes can be added, sureptase, lumbar kinase, and papain. But the wellness company has clearly been the leader on this to get ahead of it. So we see antibodies to the spike protein drop. We see the spike protein being cleared out of the bloodstream. That's all wonderful. But the messenger RNA is still there. Now, the messenger RNA, interestingly, this is actually for Kristen and Amy in particular. The messenger RNA comes out in breast milk. Breast milk is modified sweat. So if you sweat a lot, and I'll just say, I've seen enough videos of Kristen. I know she sweats when she works out.
Yes, she does.
And I do too. You know, I live in Texas. It's hot.
I just video it.
I've never done a video of myself, but people will see me. I run. I'm a big runner. I run in Dallas, no shirt, just kind of run like an animal. And I run during the heat, and I sweat a lot. And we know the messenger RNA comes out in sweat. And also the spike protein comes out in sweat. So I think sweating is one of the great non-medicinal ways of getting rid of this. And I think that's a reason why the athletes did pretty well. Initially, there was this big wave of cardiac arrests from myocarditis in the athletes. And after that, you haven't heard much because they sweat it out. This is of great concern. My son, who's a terrific athlete, he's actually ranked in the world in the half Ironman. He took 3 shots of Pfizer, and I'm greatly concerned about him, but he works out so hard. I'm hoping he's cleared most of it out of the body. Now, the issue of reverse transcription, it's been now 3 sources of data suggest that happens. But once the Pfizer and Moderna code get into the human genome, we don't know what happens. The body could repress it and it doesn't do anything. The body could edit it out and then it's quickly out of the genome, or it can be installed and then actually producing spike protein indefinitely. We don't know which one of those 3 possibilities, but because we see such impressive reductions in spike antibodies with McCullough protocol-based spike protein detoxification, I think largely the body's going to handle this. We just have to get people on the detox.
So that it does give real hope. Like, we're not here to scare people who have gotten it, because there are multiple reasons that people got it. So we don't want to scare people. We want you to know that there is a protocol and that there is hope. It does not mean like you're doomed, but we also, the most important thing is don't believe them again. Like, don't keep doing it. Don't keep doing it. Like, think for yourself, you know, just like Dr. McCullough, like even when Holly said you've had the courage, you absolutely have, but you also kept your thinking. Like, I think the thinking went out the window for a lot of people, you know?
Let me ask you, girls, do you know anybody in your circles who's still taking more shots?
No.
No, I don't think they talk to us, Dr. McCullough. I think we've offended them pretty good by now.
In my life, I encounter thousands upon thousands of people. I don't know a single one. And, you know, the CDC is not reporting to us who is taking the shots or not. They're now just kind of doing surveys and asking somebody, are you going to take the shot? So they're not reporting the actual vaccine administration data. USA Facts is a good site to quote. They take the CDC tabular data and they have it through May. So for instance, this is a hard statistic. 81% of Americans took at least 1 shot. Now, I don't know about you girls, but I didn't take them.
No, we did not, honey. No.
I think you
know about us, Dr. McCullough.
Right, right. So listen, we're in the 19% who didn't take a single shot. But listen to this. Only 70% took 2 shots. Because the first shot was so toxic, people didn't take the second one.
Right.
And then it's far fewer numbers. So, for instance, let's say children under age 2. Only 2% became fully vaccinated.
Oh, good.
So, good. Listen, I don't think anybody is taking these shots. If large numbers of people were taking shots, the CDC would report it to us, right? They would say, look at here. Remember, the CDC is a vaccine promotion unit. Their job is to promote vaccination. The FDA's job is to promote vaccination. That's the reason why they're not being pulled off the market. They are considered sponsors of the COVID-19 vaccine program. Their job is to promote vaccination. You know, they're failing miserably, Mm-hmm. Because no one's taking the shots.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let's ask you this. There's so much to unpack in this. And I love that you said the CDC is a vaccine promoter. And we hope that by now our audience at least is educated on that. We've been saying that forever since 2021, that they are promoters of the childhood vaccine schedule as well. And I love you, Dr. McCullough, because I remember when we first interviewed you, you were still not against the flu shot. And we were very much against the flu shot. And we were like, we're not taking any of that stuff right now. And you have really evolved to say, hey, when I took a look at the actual data, not what I was told by the journals, even the bought journals, not what I was told by the agencies that I've been aligned with, or even the medical schools. When I took a look at actual data, I'm alarmed at what I'm finding. So let's segue over to that for a second. The childhood vaccine schedule, you have a book out. We've ordered it. It was shipped yesterday, I think, right? Because didn't it just come out today, Dr. McCullough?
Yeah, it just came out. This is it. Vaccines, mythology, ideology, and reality. And we actually have a whole chapter on influenza vaccines.
I'm so proud of you.
Well, let me clarify. As a doctor, to be on staff at a hospital,
right?
You know, it became in the last few decades a requirement that we got a flu shot.
Right. That's right.
And you know, I would take flu shots. I didn't, you know, seemingly have any reactions to them, but I just thought it was kind of an inconvenience. And I never opted out of it. I just kind of showed up and got the shot. A couple of times I was late. And they would send me a message saying, listen, we're locking you out of the hospital unless you take a shot, you know, to go on rounds the next day. I'm like, oh, I got to go to the ER and get a shot at midnight. It was more of a bother. But I looked into it. The studies show that for adults like us, there's way less than a 1% chance we ever get influenza. Have any one of you actually ever been tested for it?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have? Yeah, I mean, I've never been tested for it, but I have a less than 1% chance of getting it. And now randomized trials show, if you get the flu shot, there's a modest reduction in flu. I mean, modest, like way less than 50% protection. But there's an increased rate of getting colds, the common colds. And that's what was happening to me. And if you saw me on national TV in 2020 and 2021, when I was taking the flu shots, I was sick almost every month. I was probably sick on the last show I did with you girls.
Yes.
And, the bottom line is it's because of the flu shot. And, you know, to make matters worse, you know, the last flu shot I got was called Fluzone. You know what? That's the one that had mercury in it.
Oh, my. When they were telling those of us who were screaming about mercury, oh, they don't do that anymore. They don't put mercury in shots anymore.
Clearly. I got some in me, and now I have stopped taking flu shots. It's now in 2021. Now it's 2025. I went a full year without a cold, first time in my life, and then I got one, me and my wife. And we're doing nasal sprays and gargles religiously. Mm-hmm. I like the one Clear, X-L-E-A-R.
For the spray.
Yeah, and the gargle spry. I did it this morning. Uh-huh. And I've had some people on my show that have gone 5, 10, even 20 years without getting a cold. That means no flu, no RSV. And the randomized trials are very convincing. Nasal sprays and gargles are far more effective than a flu shot.
I have been telling so many people about that. And did I not just see recently, because I swear I got into it with someone online, because it was an old ER nurse manager, but she never responded after I did. Didn't they just show that like the flu vaccine, like people are, it's like negative efficacy this year?
Well, that was the Cleveland Clinic. And so the Cleveland Clinic, there's a first author there, Shretho's got the data. And so the people who took the flu shot routinely, they were more likely to get the flu or probably the common cold. So it backfires. And so I don't think any healthy adult, like people in our age group, you girls are younger than me, but, you know, we don't need flu shots. Maybe somebody with severe respiratory illness, you know, the potential benefits could rise to the level that you want to do it. But, you know, the routine adult flu vaccine is on the childhood schedule now. It's completely unnecessary. It's been given to pregnant women. Mm-hmm. Now, when my wife had our kids, there were no vaccines for pregnant women. Because, you know, you don't want to provoke a fever or inflammation because that can cause a miscarriage, stillbirth, or premature delivery. And now vaccines are widely given in pregnancy, unnecessarily, and women sadly are losing their babies or having premature babies.
Oh, I mean, and the multi-dose vials had mercury in them, and we can't eat tuna, but you're going to inject me with mercury. Make it make sense.
The last flu vaccine I had was when I was pregnant. My daughter's 10 now, but it was like 10 years ago. And my OB, you know, I'm in for my appointment. I'm like probably 8 to 9 months pregnant. She bullies me into it. Basically, it's like, you really need to get this, whatever. I just remember it was right around Christmas time and I got the flu.
Terrible.
Like, really terrible flu. Could not participate in Christmas with my family. It was awful. That's the last time I ever got a shot.
Well, and you know what, Amy, you could have lost the baby.
I know. Yes. Thank God. I mean, and you know, hindsight's obviously 20. I mean, and if I would have known then what I know now,
right?
Never.
Yeah. Well, you know, I published a paper with Greg Marchand, who's an academic OB-GYN doctor. And we clearly showed this new RSV vaccine in the randomized trials is causing women to deliver children early. So a premature delivery is defined as having a baby before 37 weeks. That's where all the risks are for lung disease, intracranial hemorrhage, all these premature baby syndromes. It's awful. And so
it happened to my cousin, Dr. McCullough. She got the flu shot after being almost bullied into it by her OB and then lost the baby. And this was at 5 months. So this was, and they did an autopsy, couldn't find a reason why the baby died. And her OB had to come back and say, I do think it was the flu shot.
Oh.
Like,
I bet he didn't put it in VAERS. How much you want to bet?
Yeah.
Right. Well, here's the principle. You know, vaccines were never given to pregnant women before 2000. So it's a brand new thing. It's a brand new experiment, really. And pregnant women are not immunocompromised. In fact, the immune system is more robust during pregnancy. So pregnant women, you know, the natural process of pregnancy should just be left alone. It's not enhanced by giving, right now, there's the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, influenza, and now the RSV vaccine is given in the third trimester, and the COVID shots are given to pregnant women at any time. You know, I strongly advise natural pregnancies, no vaccines whatsoever.
Well, here's what's funny too, when you bring up the immunocompromised, sorry, Holly, but this just like, it makes, once again, it makes no sense. I have not looked at every single trial, definitely not as many as you, Dr. McCullough, but most clinical trials are not including immunocompromised people. But then their highest recommendation, like they're excluded. Like you don't have pregnant women in there. You don't have immunocompromised, you know. And then they say, oh, it's safe and we need to give you the immunocompromised people this vaccine first.
Oh, cool. Hang on. So here's the important point. So the immunocompromised are largely excluded from the registrational trials. True. Okay. When studied, the immunocompromised get little benefit from vaccination because the immune system doesn't mount much of immunity to the shot. That's been shown time and time again. So this idea that the immunocompromised, you know, are this high priority for vaccination is ill-conceived and it's not supported by the evidence. We, you know, for immunocompromised, what we need to do is be ready with treatment. We've got four FDA-approved antivirals for influenza, respiratory syncytial virus. We even have, you know, monoclonal antibodies we can use in the hospital. We use nebulization. The big issue with all of these illnesses is largely secondary bacterial infection. We saw that with the recent measles outbreak. There was a few deaths, and people died with measles, not because they died of measles. They died because they weren't treated for the bacterial secondary infection.
Yeah.
Oh, makes sense. Well, and here's the other thing. Okay, Dr. McCullough, so you speak out because science, you clearly you're such a researcher. Your ability to quote and cite resources and who did these things. We always sit there like, how does he not look at notes? How does he remember? So as you're doing your deep dives during COVID on all the things, your alarm bells go up to the childhood vaccine schedule, probably in part because you're questioning, well, if the CDC will put COVID shots on vaccine schedules for children, knowing what you know, is this what made you go, well, now I got to look at all the other ones?
Oh, for sure. And we put it in our book. We said, wait a minute. This COVID-19 vaccine debacle is probably the culmination of some very bizarre groupthink among doctors, almost like a religion.
Yes.
So what we've learned now for 300 years, doctors have taken on this false religion about vaccines. So it's not evidence-based. It's not based on facts or scientific, you know, data. It's based on a religious belief that vaccines, you know, in many ways as the ultimate hubris, that vaccines can improve upon God's creation. And, you know, the vaccinologists early on, it was even, you know, before Edward Jenner, there was Cotton Mather and Dr. Boylston in Boston, 1720. Cotton Mather, who was a minister who was doing this, he believed vaccines were a gift from God.
Oh.
Now, Cotton Mather, by the way, was also an advisor to the judges in the Salem witchcraft trials. So he believed in witchcraft. That's how this thing starts. So our book is a gripping historical account, you know, heavily cited. You've got to get it to understand how this vaccine religion has developed among doctors and public health officials. They're not thinking straight. They really are not. They think vaccines. And how this hubris goes is that, you know, we're constantly under threat of infectious diseases. There's an incredible fear. Mm-hmm. And through the brilliance of mankind, man, through science, vaccinology, can improve upon God's creation. I mean, that's the ultimate hubris. You know, Anthony Fauci's boss wrote a book called, you know, Interpreting the Language of God. These people think they're godlike. And they did. Everybody from Louis Pasteur, Edward Jenner, Fauci, Collins, they're all together on this. Hotez, they think they're godlike, but the vaccines aren't perfect. So in order for this to work, everyone must take them. This is a very important theme from the CDC, from all the pediatric societies, is that everyone must take them, okay, because they're not perfect. And if there are casualties, if some children are injured, disabled, or sadly died, you know what? We have to accept that for the greater good. That is the religion of vaccines. That's the reason why, you know, doctors typically don't care at all about vaccine injuries. They, you know, a child takes a battery of vaccines, has a sudden infant death syndrome that night. No call for alarm at all. Because
they like have weapon, and the way that they've like created this ideology with this godlike thinking is to the rest of us weaponizing our empathy and making it, you know, making it be like, well, this is for the greater good. You have to do this to protect your neighbors and the other kids that your kids are around. And, you know, the average person wants to do good. You want to be good. You want to contribute to society in a meaningful way. And so if you're not thinking and you just go along with that line of thinking and that ideology where your empathy is weaponized, then that's how we got into this mess, I feel like.
That's a very good analysis. You know, a sociologist physician in Toronto at York University, Claudia Chauffin, has published several papers on this. Should have her on your show if you haven't done it. She has demonstrated through focus group research that this indoctrination, this idea of do it for the greater good, it worked. It worked. And, you know, it worked among young college kids.
Yep.
Right. So believe it or not, the college kids, just like my son, he took the vaccines right away in January of 2021 before there were any mandates. He didn't even talk to me. And I said, Sean, what happened? He goes, I wanted to protect other people.
It was out of a good place. So for so many, it was out of a good place. And then there's more than the weaponization of our empathy was not the only thing. Now there's the demonization of those who questioned, right? Because it was a cult. So if you were questioning the leaders of the cult, if you questioned your pediatrician, they are so indoctrinated that they thought that you were the problem to society, the problem to their practice. We now know, Dr. McCullough, many of those doctors were getting kickbacks from the insurance companies for having their patients vaccinated and on schedule, which we know that they had a financial incentive for us to all vaccinate our children. We do see the truth coming to light. More and more families, we now see the childhood, more and more families are resisting the schedules. They're wanting alternate schedules. They're wanting to opt out altogether. We now have this week that the, was it the American Association of Pediatrics? They want to make sure we can no longer, myself, I've been using religious exemptions for years to opt out just because that I could use that instead of a medical one, because doctors were afraid, like Dr. Thomas, to sign off on medical exemptions because it put a target on their back to lose their license. So many of us have been using religious exemptions for a long time. Now that this association, the one that tells pediatricians basically what to do, that there should no longer be exemptions anywhere for religious exemptions or medical exemptions to vaccines. What's your take on that?
Yeah, that's the American Academy of Pediatrics, and they released that, I think, doubling down in response to a report that appeared in JAMA surveying young parents and prospective parents, and parents who were reporting only 40% were going to follow the full schedule.
Mm. That's
and
good.
I think the American Academy of Pediatrics just absolutely panicked. Yeah. And they said, well, no one should get exemptions, or certainly no religious exemptions. You know, in Texas, we have philosophical, religious, and medical exemptions.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, and I'm a member of that group, in the year 2000, this is really precedent, published a physician platform on this, that there should be no vaccine requirements to begin with for school, military, employment, et cetera. That having these requirements is it's violating our personal autonomy. It's putting people at risk. You know, not everybody can even take these vaccines
right.
safely. So, and then, of course, we have, people, they have what's called ethical and religious directives. And I was the chief academic and scientific officer for an entire Catholic health system for a period of time. So I learned about 63 Catholic ethical and religious directives. And they're pretty clear. And in Texas, we had this measles outbreak. And I had a chance to talk to one of the Mennonites. And they said, listen, Dr. McCullough, we don't take vaccines. We've never taken vaccines. We're not going to take them. The issue at hand is if people get severe measles, the doctor should treat severe measles. The mm-hmm. Amish don't take vaccines.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, many of us have seen enough. I took a ton of vaccines in my life, but I've seen enough. And every time you take a vaccine, you're taking this risk, even though it's low. I'll give you an example. One of my brother's colleagues at work took his annual flu shot. It's right in the warnings of the flu shot that you can get Guillain-Barré syndrome or paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, this guy's number came up and he's paralyzed. He's bedridden the rest of his life.
Oh.
I tell you, no flu shot is worth that.
No.
It's not worth
no.
it.
I'd
rather get the flu and just get treatment.
Yeah, do you have a suggestion? This is my great suggestion, okay? Could you send your book to everybody at the AAP? Because I feel like they need to know that. Let's mandate that before mandating any vaccines. Like, they don't, like, because before your book came out, I literally was like, they need to read Dissolving Illusions. They need to read Turtles All the Way Down. They need, like, every person, every nurse, every healthcare professional, I feel like they need to know the actual history of vaccines instead of just getting the whole indoctrinated, you know, education of, oh, vaccines saved millions of lives, just do it. You know,
you mentioned two important books, and we rely on them in our book, but we also recognize the shortcomings. Turtles All the Way Down is a very authoritative discourse of the trials done in vaccines, but its shortcoming is the authors are so fearful that they wrote it anonymously.
Yep.
And, you know, that just never goes over. well. Yep. It doesn't. Yeah. It's just like a Twitter profile where someone is afraid to reveal their name. Right. So they go by some fake name. It's just I never quote these people with it because I don't know who they are. Right. Now, Dissolving Illusions was written by Roman Bistionic and Suzanne Humphreys, and she's a nephrologist. It's very authoritative. It's the most referenced historical piece, and we rely on it a lot in our book. But our book is describing the development of the religion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these other books are the fact pattern of what happened with vaccines. But what we fully uncover is the religion. And now this new dangerous era, the last part of our book, the timeline, we call it the bioweapons era, started around 2003. And that is, you know, vaccines in pandemic and pandemic response and biological warfare and countermeasures. Now things with this vaccine religion have gotten very dangerous. And we've already had one global pandemic and, you know, a vaccine incubator, the Center for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, you know, founded by Gates Foundation and World Economic Forum, big center. These, you know, they have enormous resources. They predict one pandemic after another, what's called Disease X pandemics, because they're going to come out of bio labs. And there will be only one response to each one, mass vaccination.
Right.
Well, and that reminds me of something to ask you about too, Dr. McCullough. We know that Gates, as you mentioned, was really behind the mass vaccination over in Africa for polio. And then suddenly, and you can go back and CNN reported on it in like 2018, 2019, somewhere around there, that there were outbreaks of polio from the shedding of the vaccines that were being given in Africa. There's a lot of questions, and we actually, our viewers wanted to ask you about the shedding of the COVID vaccine. Number one, is that a fact that the COVID vaccine can shed? And number two, what are you telling us and those of us who are unvaccinated, anything that we should or could be doing, should we be doing the same kind of detoxes as a result?
Well, let me take the last one first. Yes, I think virtually anybody who's had COVID should be doing a detox. I'm still seeing spontaneous blood clots, heart attacks, other problems of people who just had COVID, not the vaccines. Mm-hmm. The detox, which is natokinase, bromelain, and curcumin, that's the wellness company Ultimate Spike Detox, or even just a low-level spike support, which is natokinase and some minor ingredients. People can take that couple of capsules a day. The Japanese do it anyway to prevent heart disease. So it's generally healthy for you to do this. And you know, the natokinase and bromelain are antithrombotic, proteolytic. They have general heart benefits. And then the curcumin is anti-arthritic. Curcumin is actually also anti-cancer. So we probably ought to be taking curcumin anyway. So, yeah, I think everybody should be on this. This would probably lessen the burden of everything we're seeing out there. And then very importantly, shedding occurs, and probably the most expert person on this, you may want to have her on your show, is Helene Benoun. She's at Inserm in France, and she's demonstrated for sure shedding happens. A freshly vaccinated person, you know, can exude spike protein through little lysosomes to others through exhaled breath or body secretions. But I think it's a low-level immunologic challenge. I don't think it's significant. We haven't seen any messenger RNA transfer except from mother to baby, which is scary. You know, mothers should not be taking genetic vaccines and have it transmit to the baby.
Well, that's very encouraging to know that it is only spike protein, which we don't want that either. But the messenger RNA is very concerning to me because of, like you said, we really don't even know what that's doing inside the body. We really don't know long-term what's going to happen there. Okay. So I have to ask you some cardiology questions because obviously we're seeing an uptick in cardiac events as a result of COVID and the COVID vaccinations. We have been following, and I think you know, Dr. Asim Malhotra, we've been following him for years because he really was, like you, a courageous whistleblower about statins not doing everything that they were claiming it could do. So I want to ask you, you're the expert, you're another expert. What's your take on statins and what are you suggesting for your patients to take as a more natural alternative to statins?
Well, the first point is cholesterol does cause the blockages in the heart. That's probably the inciting factor. And then there's inflammation. But there's no doubt about it. When we take somebody with heart blockages and we cut open the artery, it's cholesterol is there. The other thing that's, I think, bedrock is any way that we lower cholesterol will reduce the risk of heart blockages, heart attack, and stroke, for sure. Mm-hmm. So it's before statins, we had other drugs, and they were tried, and they lowered cholesterol in the bloodstream, and heart attacks and strokes went down. There's actually been a form of intestinal surgery that did that. So the cholesterol hypothesis is one of the most solid hypotheses in all of medicine.
But now,
statins, so it's solid. For sure, cholesterol is a major part of the problem. Now, I take statins. I remember practicing before statins, and statins came in, and they've been refined. The very first statin had a lot of toxicity. That was lovastatin. I think probably the least toxic statin on the market, which is also the strongest, is rosuvastatin. We have about 36 large, prospective, double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trials. And for sure, statins reduce the risk of heart attack, bypass surgery, stenting, and stroke. For sure. For sure.
Now, is this for just prevention or if they've already had a heart attack?
Because it's been tried for prevention and it works. Mm-hmm. And for people who have established blockages and it works. Now, for prevention, the effect is a little smaller because some people aren't destined to have these problems and other people are. And then for those with established blockages, the effect is stronger. But so that's convincing. Now, the downside to statins is in the best studies, about 15% of people can't take them, largely because of muscle aches. Mm-hmm. But everybody has muscle aches. I have some now after my yoga lesson. And so, I don't want to misinterpret that as saying, wow, that's my statin. People misinterpret side effects. So, but statins in general are so safe that they're over the counter. Let me finish. Statins are so safe that they're over-the-counter in the UK, which I think that's the right thing. I think statins should be over-the-counter in the United States and just let people make their own choice on using statins or not. And I tell people, listen, it's not a dictatorial thing. If people don't want to take statins, they don't have to. But they can't, be belly aching when they're in the ER with a heart attack or a stroke. It's just you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, I want to be free of statins, but I don't want to have a stroke or heart attack. You can't have your cake and eat it too.
So what about the people? I know of a gentleman who got, after being put on statins, started having memory loss significantly. And then that we know that's a side effect as the CoQ10 can be depleted. What do you do to try to mitigate the depletion of that CoQ10 that can come from being on a statin?
Well, it's not as straightforward as that. There's been, again, I think in this case, 31 studies of studying statins and cognitive decline. So, the development of kind of mild memory impairment or dementia. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, statins protect against the development of dementia and cognitive decline. So in this person whose memory started to change, it wasn't due to the statin. It's just the published study showed just the opposite. But people get confused. And I think there is a popularism to contrarians. And, the person who wrote the book, David Brownstein wrote it, it's called The Statin Disaster, where he makes these allegations, statins and memory loss or statins and these other things. And I said, David, the published studies show just the opposite. I said, are you going to, meet these patients in the ER when they have their heart attacks and stuff? He goes, well, no, that's your job.
Oh, gosh.
So what we don't want to do is make large mistakes. You started out by saying I was right on everything during COVID, and I am the most published person who's opined on any of these issues, in the world.
Yeah.
And so I'm telling you that statins have a major role in coronary heart disease. 96% of cardiologists take them. We don't want to end up with stents or bypass surgery. I had a patient yesterday who absolutely positively refuses to take statins, and that's his choice. And he's already had bypass surgery, and yesterday he was in the cardiac cath lab and getting stents. And, you know, that's his choice. But, yeah, but there is a free choice that people have, but there's a consequence here. It's not free. And so
what I have learned recently is, I mean, Holly, when you're saying if you got a depletion of the CoQ10, people can supplement with the CoQ10 if they are taking the statin, right?
Leave statins out of it. Just CoQ10 is a necessary cofactor for the heart muscle. And, there have been published reviews on this. I published one on my Substack where every study shows if you take CoQ10, there's lower rates of heart attack heart failure and cardiac death.
Yeah.
Right. So CoQ10 is a winner. I took mine this morning and, the doses should be much higher than what people think. So in the published review, it's at least 400 milligrams a day. So I recommend 800. I take the 800 milligram ubiquinol vegan ones. And they're perfect.
What about red yeast rice? Is it red yeast rice extract?
Red rice yeast is the most toxic statin, which is lovastatin. So in general, I tell people, don't take that. That's the most toxic statin. You might as well just take a real statin, a generic drug, or in the UK, just buy one over the counter. It'll be a lot safer. So
how is it toxic? Okay.
Lovastatin is more toxic to the liver, and it causes more muscle aches. So we don't, if you notice, doctors do not use lovastatin. And that's what red rice yeast is, lovastatin. It's considered a natural statins. That's the other thing people don't realize. Statins are a natural product. But everything has risks and benefits.
Sure.
Patients with coronary heart disease should be on statins. If they can't take statins, we prescribe injections called Repatha, so it gets even tougher. And those for prevention, the best method on prevention, this came out probably about 10 years ago in our guidelines, is if people are having this angst over taking statins, they should get a coronary artery calcium score over age 45. Get a coronary, and if cholesterol is building up there and the calcium identifies it, if they have blockages developing, it becomes fairly compelling. Take a statin.
Is there anything, Dr. McCullough, that you do suggest in terms of supplementation or natural things? Or, we obviously have always known exercise and nutrition plays a role for sure, in heart disease. But is there any supplements that you personally take or that you suggest or anything that you have found is helpful outside of just your traditional statins or medications?
Well, yeah, let's just start with a few. So aspirin has a role every day, so over the counter. I don't think you have to take it every day. I take it every other day and days I travel. It has a slight reduction in heart attack and stroke, and actually a slight reduction in colon cancer as well. So aspirin is up there. We've already covered CoQ10. I think that data are very solid there. Most people need some additional B vitamins, especially Caucasians. We have a genetic mutation called MTHFR. About a quarter of us have it. So we should just take a super B complex. So I think that's on base. Yeah. Everybody should take a broad-based multivitamin. And the minimum daily requirements are too low. So we know that. We've published reviews on that. So I like the mega vitamins. I personally like the GNC Women's Active, actually for both men and women. That's the one I take. You have to take it every day, but I think a couple times a week.
Okay.
Another good supplement to take is omega-3 fatty acids.
That's what I was going to ask.
So omega-3 fatty acids, they protect against heart attack and stroke, but by a different mechanism. They don't lower cholesterol. But the one I like is Viva Naturals. If you take two of those a day, VIVA, that gives you about 2,000 milligrams of DHA and EPA. That's actually what the good of what you want to get out of that. And then I think for a lot of people, particularly those who are overweight, heading towards diabetes, there's more and more data for berberine. Berberine is actually a head-to-head trial of berberine versus metformin, and they were about the same. Berberine clearly lowers glucose, improves insulin sensitivity. Wellness Company's got a great product. It's called Peak Metabolism. It's berberine plus cinnamon has an effect, and banana leaf extract. And so I think when you're going for supplements, you know, you should look at the wellness company, because we do very few single supplements. Everything is kind of packed with four or five ingredients to give you the best value there. So, you know, I've spent some time with natural doctors. I think probably the most impressive natural doctor I've talked to is, his name is Michael Gaeta, G-A-E-T-A. You should have him on your show. And he's impressed me. He said, listen, if you want to go a more natural route and be a less dependent on pharmaceuticals, it's probably going to take 4 to 6 natural supplements a day.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. That's where I am right now. But I don't want people in the medical freedom movement to think, wow, you know, I'm free and clear. I'm going to stop all my prescription drugs. Well, maybe if you're young and thin and athletic like you girls, you know, you can go a period of time where you're not going to need prescription medications. But I got to tell you, by age 80, if you want to make it to 80, about 90% of people need some medicinal help. Yeah. It's just a fact of life. There's about 10% of men or women who are 80 that have never taken a prescription drug chronically, but it's only 10%.
Yeah, I think a lot of it too, Dr. McCullough, has just come from, obviously we know this, and COVID exposed that the regulatory agencies that were supposed to keep pharma in check failed. And so some people had horrible experiences on pharmaceuticals. Obviously, we saw the withdrawal of pharmaceuticals that ended up being dangerous. You know, I think all of that transpiring, people have had a personal experience where they have learned to question and to doubt, and also maybe perhaps seeing that taking one medication led to them having to take another, and then it's like medical whack-a-mole, you know, treat this over here, but now we got to treat this because there was this consequence. And so I do think that the average American is getting to this place where you don't have to be anti-Western medicine. You don't have to be anti-pharmaceuticals, but you're trying to do everything you can, as you just said, to live as healthy and as long as possible without them, so that, you know, they're only as necessary and not the first thing that we run to. Because I think for so long, we ran to our doctors and that's what we were given. We were given a prescription for something that we could have maybe perhaps changed with lifestyle.
Right. Well, we've had this debate actually with some of the natural doctors. And, you know, I think one of the problems is there's too few naturopathic doctors. There's about 1 million MDs and DOs in the United States, 500,000 PAs, but there's only about 70,000 natural doctors. You know, if every patient had a natural doctor and my office became relieved of some of the caseload, that would be terrific. So I think natural first is perfectly fine, but we don't want to be misled. And, you know, be careful with doctors who don't see patients. And that would be, you know, Malhotra or Malone, what have you. As soon as they stop seeing patients and they lose their clinical sense of what's going on, some of the claims get to be exaggerated and not evidence-based. And I think, frankly, dangerous. You know, I've talked to Malhotra about it, where he said, well, statins don't work on a secondary endpoint of stroke in a randomized trial. I said, listen, that's not the mainline effect. We're giving statins to reduce the risk of, you know, coronary artery disease. And, he needs someone to be corrected. So remember, this idea of religion is dangerous in medicine. So if he's anti-statin, that's a religion. You want to be careful with that. You know, anti-vax. You know, again, that's kind of a religion. Everybody who, there is evidence and there is a way of factually sifting through all of this. And with every decision, there's risks and benefits. I mean, that's, we have to finish on that. There's risks and there's benefits. And it's only through interchange like this that we can weigh things out.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that's a good call out too, because that's why we existed as a podcast. Just think, it was to not be tribal, to not go all in on any one thing, but to just think for yourself and to do, as we're saying, you sift through the information from a myriad of sources and find, you know, the most reliable things to make your own personal decisions about everything, instead of saying, well, I'm this or I'm that, or I align with this doctor or that doctor or this movement or that movement, but to instead, you know, keep an open mind and be willing to really critically think and sift through the information to try to find the truth, you know?
Yes.
And you've been doing that, Dr. McCullough. We appreciate you so much. We know you got to go to a patient and help them out. Right. So we're not going to keep you any longer, but thank you so much for all that you do. We appreciate you so much. Thanks for giving us
so much.
Thank you.